Next, on the Capital Connection, Andrew Rhine. He's the president of the Citizens Budget Commission. They're critical of how New York spends money, and they say they are out to support New Yorkers. We'll talk about the state budget, school aid, Medicaid, housing, and much more. That's Andrew Rhine, president of the Citizens Budget Commission, on this week's Capital Connection. Next. Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. Joining us this week is Andrew Rhine. He is the president of the Citizens Budget Commission, which describes itself as a nonpartisan, nonprofit civic organization, a think tank, whose mission is to achieve constructive change in the finances and services of New York City and New York State government. They say their mission is rooted in serving the citizenry at large, rather than narrow special interests, preserving public resources, whether financial or human, and focusing on the well-being of future New Yorkers, the most underrepresented group in city and state government. This comes from their website, where you can find out more, cbcny.org. Andrew Rhine, president of the Citizens Budget Commission, welcome to the Capital Connection.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Tell us a little bit more about yourself. I was looking at your bio. I see you also have some extensive healthcare experience as well. Most notably, you were with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
I've been at this business for a long time. In the 90s, after graduate school, I spent 5 years at the Citizens Budget Commission. In fact, as a kid, focusing on New York State budgets, so I have a long history. But then I took a detour as I was executive deputy commissioner of the health department in New York City and then associate director for the Centers for Disease Control, so spending a lot of time in public health and healthcare, which helps ground me when we talk about the budgets, especially the fiscal issues and then the service issues that really matter at the core of it.
So I'm guessing it's those fiscal issues that brought you back to the CBC.
You know, what brought me back in part was the fact that CBC is always proffering fact-based research and encouraging evidence-based policymaking. And in a world where there's so much polarization, so much partisanship, and people using fake information to advocate for positions, CBC focuses on using the facts, trying to ground the debate, and then the policies in those facts. And I thought that this is a really important time to do that. And if I could have my shot to help in New York, that would be great.
Well, just so people have a complete picture of the organization, you are a nonprofit. Can you give our listeners a sense of how your organization is funded? Is it membership-based?
It is primarily funded by our trustees, which we have around 150 trustees. These are civic and business and some nonprofit leaders in New York who all come together, leave their particular business interests at the door, but bring their expertise in the room to help guide and steer our research. and keep us grounded in those practical recommendations. So it's a very interesting model because we are funded by them, but they really also have a hand in helping us determine what to research. And then when we make practical recommendations, they help keep them practical. Some have been in and out of government, some working in, you know, communications, consulting, law, real estate, but it's very good in that way because sometimes think tanks can come up with spreadsheet type of ideas that actually cannot be implemented by public officials. They bring something real to the table to keep us grounded.
We are speaking with Andrew Rhine, president of the Citizens Budget Commission, and we are in a major budget week, and kind of an interesting one at that. The governor came out and said we have the parameters of an agreement. The next day, the leadership, the speaker, Senate leader said, "Now hold on a second, we're not finished negotiating the final details, but we do know it's a $237 billion plan, and we also know that most of that plan gets negotiated among those three leaders." You've released a statement already on the conceptual agreement, basically saying, you know, it appears to take New York State further in the wrong direction, end quote.
Thank you. Yes. Listen, I think the first two things you said are very important, which is it ain't over till it's over. But the governor also did announce, and certainly take it at her word, and even when we listen to the other two leaders, there is a framework for a conceptual agreement. I think they're working within that framework to finalize the details, not only on fiscal issues, which is frankly the guts of what a budget should be, but also a lot of the discussion is on the policy issues, which some will, but many will not have direct fiscal implications. But in New York's tradition, they're all bound together in negotiation. We can come back to that. But what we see from all the information provided is revenues are strong in New York. The economy has been doing well, but instead of using those strong receipts to stabilize New York's fiscal foundation, the budget adds more and more spending, which is unaffordable in the long run. When you looked at what the governor had originally proposed, there was not only a $10 billion future budget gap, but structurally, meaning once you got rid of the kind of budget helpers on one time and temporary tax increases go away, the state has a structural budget gap of $16 billion. What we're seeing from the preliminary information coming out is that structural budget gap is not lower and may well be higher, but it's at least $16 billion. What that means, that's just not budget wonky stuff. That means that at some point in time, we hit a wall. And if we don't manage that better than we seem to be doing right now, that wall hurts people.
Well, so what's the fix? What would you recommend?
So it's interesting. You know, New York State, when if you were to helicopter in from outer space and you were to listen to the debate, you would think, oh, my gosh, we don't do anything for anybody. There are so many needs. We must be the lowest spending state, and we must be cutting, cutting, cutting. So the first thing to do is think about the context. You know, it's interesting. New York State and localities, and that's the best data we have to compare around the country, We spend, and the state is the majority of this, we spend the second highest amount per capita in the country. And yes, the country is a diverse place, but we spend more than California, more than Connecticut, more than New Jersey, more than Massachusetts, and certainly more than some competitors of ours in Florida and Texas. So we spend a lot. And then you look at what New York State has been doing in recent years. We came through a pandemic and a recession, which one would normally think would be a contracting budgetary time. But when you look at state operating funds, which obviously, as you said, this whole state budget, including federal money, is $237 billion, but the kind of guts that we take out of the state economy to run the operations, not capital investment, run the operations, that's around $130 billion. When you look at what has happened in New York State between fiscal 21, that's like slightly into the recession, to what the governor's proposed, we've increased state operating funds $32.5 billion, mostly around 8% a year. And the governor proposed, and this is at the tail of this, the governor already proposed to increase spending $4.8 billion. That's over 4%. And now inflation has reduced a little bit. So we are a high spending state that is increasingly spending more and more each year. And we should be able to provide the services New Yorkers need within that level. So what we recommend is, as I mentioned, we have this $16 billion structural budget gap. If we could restrain spending, maybe 2% a year, maybe around inflation. We could actually reduce that over time. That would stabilize us and help the state be able to protect New Yorkers in the future.
What do you account for that increased spending, though? Was there anything to the fact that the pandemic saw a lot of federal money flow into the states, including New York, and their eyes got a little too big for their stomach?
Well, I think what's interesting here, you put a good point in. I'm talking about this $32 billion that we increased state spending. That's about the state money. The Fed dumped a lot of money. There was a lot of aid. This is, you know, both administrations put a lot of money into New York, and $13 billion in New York in education, and then another around $7 billion, if I recall correctly, into other aid. Lots of money came in. So what happens is when all the money flows in, and we have extra federal money, you think, hey, we have extra federal money, maybe we can save some of ours. And we did. We actually helped, as I talked about, that structural budget gap. The annual budget gaps are a little smaller because we spread out some of our largesse, frankly, in New York coming from the financial industry as much as any, or more than anything else. We spread that out. But the reality is we kept on spending like the money's burning a hole in our pocket. And the bottom line is that doesn't last forever. And we built up our spending base. The governor had some, she proposed some savings plans in Medicaid and education, and that's important. That's around two-thirds of our budget. But the legislature appears to have rejected most of those. And so even though she proposed to spend, increase spending 4%, it's going to go up higher because that is New York's way to try to do more for more people. But as you mentioned in our mission statement, you know, they like to say in Albany there are three people in a room. Obviously, there are more people involved and their staffs involved. But you know who's not in that room? Future New Yorkers. And they're the ones who are going to suffer if we do not live within our means.
Well, and there are other ways to reduce waste. And, you know, you mentioned the two other areas of the budget, education and healthcare. Let's talk about healthcare. Medicaid, for example, this is huge. I spoke to the comptroller, Tom DiNapoli, fairly recently, and he talks about all these recommendations he puts out for saving on Medicaid. And, you know, these proposals that he basically says, you know, I can't enforce it. Nobody's really reading them and instituting them. So I know you guys have weighed in on Medicaid, and you've said, quote, it's unfortunate that the legislature rejected most of the governor's proposals to restrain Medicaid spending. Remind our listeners what those were.
Stepping back, everyone should think about two different kind of pots. One is the comptroller has done repeated audits and identified things, including misspending, spending more, sending checks to people we don't need to or providers we don't need to. We need to tighten up those systems, and Tom DiNapoli has done great work on this. We also need to think about the long term, who is eligible for what service and how we are paying for those. You know, we spend more per Medicaid recipient than almost anybody in the country, and we cover more people. So, you know, we hit it on all sides. We have some waste and fraud that we need to take care of. We cover more people, which can be a very good and important thing, but we also spend more for each case. And what the governor proposed was what is being adopted, which is important, is the consumer-directed personal health services. You know, we have the most generous program in the country where we pay family members to do personal care at home. And listen, keeping people at home is very important. It's both humane, good for care. But we have originated and grown a program that is now billions of dollars that used to not exist, far beyond the rest of the country. This is now a five-ish billion-dollar program that just a few years ago we were not spending money on. This is one of our budget busters. The state and the legislature has reportedly agreed to start to constrain that by having one intermediary, and they say they'll save a few hundred million dollars. That is the first step, but we really have to get more of a handle on it. And the governor has focused on that. She also talked about bringing down some rates and controlling rates, and that has been rejected by the legislature. It's interesting. Our Medicaid spending program, even after the governor's proposals, is going to increase 7% a year, which is unsustainable from here on, you know, in the financial plans to the future. We have to bring that growth rate down because it is simply unsustainable. Our tax revenues are not increasing at the same rate. We've got to figure out how to do that because Medicaid's around a third of our budget. If we don't control that, we can't manage the future.
Well, and the future for schools and school aid is an interesting one. I believe I read that it looks like the hold harmless proposal that the governor put in to do away with that In other words, to do away with the automatic raising of aid to schools each year. She wanted to do some more targeting of aid in those places where they need it most. Now, of course, we fund our schools through the property tax system, which quite obviously will impact those communities with less of a property tax base negatively, more negatively than those who live in wealthier areas. Now, you guys are looking at what you call a target and tighten sustainable path for schools. So how does that jive with Hold Harmless and the education talks going on right now?
We spend more per student in New York than anybody in the country, and our results aren't manifesting our high spending. We should have the best outcomes for the highest spending, and that's not happening. But it's interesting. The governor is exactly right, and we have for years talked about reforming the system to target, as you say, target and tighten, to target the money where it's needed most, and make it affordable, tighten it up so it can be affordable in the long run. And one of the targets that we focused on, and the governor was exactly right, is getting rid of the Hold Harmless. So here's how it works. You know, you get school aid per pupil, and there are all these different factors based on need, and there are a number of different school aid streams. We don't have to go into all the details. But if the school district's enrollment declines, one would think that their needs for finances decline, but this Hold Harmless said, oh, we're going to give you as much as we gave you last year. Don't worry about it. So there's this upward type of ratchet effect from the Hold Harmless. And we have districts where enrollment has declined around the state, yet we've continued to give them the same or more money over time. And the governor said, hold on a second. This is actually costing us more than we should be spending. We're giving money to districts that don't need it because they've been shrinking. And as she has pointed out, and her budget staff, Lake Washington's budget director and others, have pointed out that some of these school districts have reserves because they haven't used the money. They've got plenty in their pocket. And this is one of the exact right areas to try to restrain spending because, listen, education is probably the most important thing we do. But if we can't do everything for everybody, we've got to focus on the districts and the schools and the kids that need it most. And so she tried to reduce that and save a few hundred million by that, and that's been rejected by the legislature, which is really unfortunate. We also, at the Citizens Budget Commission, have pointed out that the state gives over $2 billion a year to wealthy districts that, using their own tax money and regular federal aid, these districts self-fund without any state aid at all what the state constitution guarantees every student, which is a sound basic education. So the state, many localities, some wealthy localities, use their money and a little federal money that they get every year, and they already provide what the state constitution guarantees, yet we still spend around $2.4 billion of state money goes to those localities. That money, obviously, as we see the state budget in fiscal stress, that money is one of the places we should look at reducing, but also we should target that money to the districts that are higher in need. That's where we talk about tightening up and targeting to in-need districts. If we do not get a handle on school aid, we have a budget problem, but we also need to support districts with high-need kids and districts that don't have as much local revenue for those high-need kids to be able to serve them well. The other missing piece of the stool, quite frankly, if I may, there's a lot of discussion, certainly right now in Albany, about mayoral in New York City, whether the mayor can control the schools, can be in charge and have the accountability for the school system. It's interesting. The state is talking about that, but yet, when it distributed $13 billion of federal school aid during the pandemic, there was not a program to help districts use this to maximize student achievement, to accelerate, to reverse learning loss, and to narrow those education disparities. We need not only to spend the right money in the right place at the state, but we also have to make sure schools are using it well and serving our kids.
Well, and we're going back two decades with the Campaign for Fiscal Equity starting that lawsuit. They won, and the state still didn't put the money in. Then they, as you suggest, but we still don't have an equitable distribution of the resources for schools in this state. So beyond keeping it in the property tax formula, Is there any sense to funding it directly out of the budget and target those districts and give them what they need out of the general fund?
Well, look, the state 4 years ago now finally made a decision and increased school aid tremendously to what is called fully fund foundation aid, which is, in a certain sense, the progeny of the Campaign for Fiscal Equity, right, the CFE suit. So there was an incredible increase, which is why when the governor said we need to restrain that, they were on a base, which is so much more, and I don't have the money. I think it was basically a 30% increase over 3 years to do that. The challenge with it is how that was structured in the school aid formulas. It gave money, which was needed for high-need districts, and that was important, but it also gave money to these wealthy districts because the way the formula works is it doesn't matter if they have enough money from their local tax base. The state's going to give them extra money anyway. Now, the governor has talked in her press conference the other night that she has, well, the legislature has rejected the hold harmless for now. It will be revisited for next year. They will work with, I believe, the Rockefeller Institute to do a study and the state education department to do a study about how to change foundation aid for next year. I hope, although past has not proved very to give me much optimism, but they need to look at the foundation aid formula, which does generally target to need, so it's beneficial, but they need to target it more to need, get rid of hold harmless, and I hope they also look at some of the expense-based aids. You know, school districts, around a third of the money that's distributed, a little less than a third, is based on school districts all spending and getting some portion of that spending from the state and state aid. Those expense-based needs aids, most of them should be distributed based on need anyway. If you get rid of hold harmless, modernize some of the factors in the formula, and fold in what is now expense-based aids, some portion of that, you will target the money better. So let's hope, let's be optimistic, and say everyone should come to the table and support a reform of the foundation aid formula that actually does exactly what we're talking about here today.
He is Andrew Rhine, president of the Citizens Budget Commission. Well, you can be optimistic. I'm not so optimistic, Andrew. I tend to believe when you send it out for study, that's just a delay tactic, and that the lawmakers themselves can sit down. They've been looking at this for how many years? They can sit down and make these decisions. So I apologize, but I don't have as much hope on this one.
Well, as I said, you know, I had a six-year stint of this in the 90s, and I think that can kicking is a skill that at times is one of the best at. You're right that often a commission or a study is used to divert attention, say we've made some progress and we'll make future progress. But I do think that we should all be feeding into that process. And as we said in the beginning, as you said so well, talked about our mission, future New Yorkers who are going to have to pay these bills have to be at that table, because we do need education aid to be both sustainable as well as targeted.
Speaking of sustainable, the ability of having enough housing so that we can give people places to live. I mean, this is not only in New York, it's everywhere. So, you know, we've got this housing issue. The governor tried it last year. It looks like they may be closer to agreement now. I'm not sure of all the details here, but, you know, we have to be smart about this. We have so many people that can't afford the affordability, and then there's the availability.
You're exactly right. And, you know, not that markets work perfectly, but as we all learned in our economics 101, if you increase a lot of supply, the price will go down. What New York needs to do, certainly in New York City and the downstate region, but there are pockets of this all around the state. This, you know, this is a national and a statewide crisis. We need to increase the supply because people need to be able to move, find housing, and when we increase the supply enough, it will help affordability. Of course, there's still places, including in New York City, where you need to have incentives to make sure that some of these units or some of these houses are affordable, whether they be renter or homeowners. So we hope that this agreement can cost effectively drive the production New York needs to remedy both the availability crisis and the affordability crisis. Devil's in the details. You don't want to give away too much money. You don't want to give away too much money that is not needed, but you need to get those incentives right so that we build the housing. We need massive investment in production from the private sector with some incentives from the public sector to focus on both production and affordable units. You know, we're glad some of the elements we're hearing out of Albany are helpful in New York City in terms of increasing density and some available programs from the former 421A program that were started, having more time to complete. But the devil here is really in the details. But everyone has finally come together to say there's a problem. The question is the solution actually going to address the problem effectively?
Well, it dawns on me, of course, that these problems impacting New Yorkers paying for health care, affordable rent and housing, you know, we have seen this year a raise in the minimum wage in New York and the city area, of course, getting a little bit more than the rest of upstate. But there are these arguments that even a raise in the minimum wage for so many Americans, Americans with families, is not enough to pay the rent, the mortgage, whatever it might be. And there's been these calls for a living wage. You know, if the cost of living increases, the COLAs that many of us get kept pace with actual inflation, people would be getting a lot more in terms of a minimum wage.
There is no question that for too many New Yorkers, residents of this country, the gap between what should be a good standard of living and what they earn is modest or high for some, and that's a real problem. We have obviously targeted programs in New York and other places for this. The interesting thing is, as we bring up the wage floor structurally, minimum wage, living wage, it also cycles through the economy, increases costs, and increases government spending. So it's a delicate public policy balance, and I think that's very important. What we're doing in New York is trying to boost housing production. That'll help bring down prices because you want to bring up wages with good jobs, both regulation but also deregulation, so that companies can come and create good jobs, and that's where government has to get out of the way to boost the economy, not get in the way. So we want to bring up wages, but we also want to bring down costs, which is, of course, what we're trying to do with housing production. There are also programs in energy to make sure as we transition to renewable energy, can we make sure that energy increase cost, which is going to affect many New Yorkers. This is coming down the pipe, and people aren't talking about it probably enough. But how is that going to affect the lowest income New Yorkers? It's a delicate balance on those. But if you go too high with trying to increase wages, by a mandated level, you end up increasing costs and increasing inflation. You have to have that balance. So the key is housing production and job creation.
He is Andrew Rhine, the president of the Citizens Budget Commission. You can learn more about the nonprofit organization at cbcny.org. I apologize, Andrew. We're out of time. We hope you'll come back and join us again on the Capital Connection.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. You can listen to The Capital Connection anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. For The Capital Connection, I'm David Giustina.
Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.